All right.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Good morning, Mr. Edwards, on this cloudy day. How you doing?
Good morning, Mr. Allen. It is somewhat of a cloudy day. We've had some great days, though, here, actually, since back at the first of July. So you got to take, you know, what it is, because in another 2.5 months, we'll be talking about bumbling up. And et cetera. So we have to enjoy what it is that we are receiving, if you will. A lot of things going on in our beloved Shangri-La. My definition for the wonderful place that is Minnesota, with all of its liberalism and et cetera. I heard your kind of your introduction, if you will. And I just want to tell you, this morning here on the Saturday program, my hero is Federal Judge Michael Davis. He is my hero. Of course, he's been a friend of mine for many, many, many years. We served together, my God, almost 50 years ago, as members of the then effective and vigilant Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, if you will. I don't know the last time that the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission has had a public hearing. I think it was back in the days of Bill Davis. You remember Bill Davis? He's in federal penitentiary.
Yes, sir.
Now.
Yes, sir.
But a big mover and shaker, you know, dynamic spokesperson for the Negro race, if you will. But anyway, Civil Rights Commission hasn't had a public hearing on anything in over 20 years, man. And I guess it's acceptable for whoever it is. But anyway, my hero this morning here in the Twin Cities is Federal Judge Michael Davis. Because if it had not been for him, my friend, Clark family, the Jamara Clark family, would not have received a single penny, if you will. And I understand the motivation of your statement of declaration of tuning in to this program, because I'm just trying to figure out at what point anybody was going to ever say anything about what Minneapolis City government, and particularly the mayor and others, did to the Clark family. You know, as we discussed in not only our production meeting, but a couple of our programs, you know, they negotiated or pretended to negotiate, they being the city of Minneapolis and the city attorney, quote-unquote, chief counsel. They negotiated or pretended to negotiate with this family of colored people for over a year. And as soon as the Noor trial was over, they met in closed session and awarded $20 million to the Australians. To her
yes.
family, the deceased, if you will. They then told the coloreds, the black people, the Negroes, that there was no money left to provide them with anything. And it was only because of not only the courage, but the decency of Federal Judge Michael Davis, former chief judge of the Federal District Court of Minnesota, until he was required by age, if you will, to step away into senior status. It was not until that black judge stood up on a Monday in Minneapolis a week after the Mohamed Noor trial, Mr. Allen, and ordered, sent United States Marshals to the offices of the mayor, city council president, the chief of police, the general counsel, and one other person, and told them that they would forthwith be present in his courtroom on that Wednesday. A woman, what's her name? Rochelle Olson, as Minneapolis starts to be. They really wanted to attack Judge Davis, but you got to be real careful, man, with regards to attacking a sitting federal judge, if you know what I mean. But anyways, whatever the Clark family got, which was $200,000, I think about 1.5 cents on the dollar when you compare it to $20 million. Whatever it was that they got, they owe it. to Judge Michael Davis. And, you know, I have not seen a single one of our organizations and our many great leaders. Have you seen them, Don? Maybe I missed it. Have you seen them speak out?
It's so quiet out.
Thank you. Praise.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, seen any formal, you know, press conferences, Mr. Edwards. And, you know, I just look around and I wonder what is the point of them even being around or having a name, because this is an opportunity to step in and start some conversations, do, you know, and inform the community, because you have people not understanding the Judge Davis piece at all whatsoever. First time they're hearing it is right here usually because they don't read the newspaper. So
that's a huge
issue, but I haven't heard the Minneapolis Urban League, NAACP, and Black Lives Matter. I remember all that protest down on Plymouth Avenue, Mr. Edwards, and other places, and people that were there were saying that, hey, there was these, you know, kind people coming up to some of these point people at these protests and putting money in envelopes in their hands. And,
in fact, there are security, there are pictures taken by the FBI of them showing good white, decent white folks handing, in fact, there was one Pacific minister, and just so nobody gets confused, it was not the Reverend Jerry McAfee. There was one Pacific minister, in fact, he declared himself to be the religious, spiritual leader for the group. They were sending him quite a few of those envelopes, if you will. Maybe he'll use it to fix up his church. But anyway, hey, I don't know what it is that folks really want, but I have yet to see any expression of appreciation, nor did I see much when the news story broke under the byline of the reporter Rochelle Olson, that Judge Davis had summoned under color of law. And for those that know their legal dictionary, they understand why yours truly always makes that declaration under color of law. And when he sent United States Marshals to deliver the document to them indicating they were to appear in his court, and then, you know, he did what he did. And then the Star Tribune had made sure they didn't write much about it for the last month. But the good judge clearly put a timeline, a deadline on the so-called leadership, if you will, of city government, et cetera. So they just had it. Apparently, they just came in about 12 hours under the deadline. But again, you know, I assume that the leadership was out there fighting for that 200,000, I guess. I don't know, Tom. I mean, what's your take?
No, I mean, Ms. Edwards, I think my take, and I might see for you a little bit, not all the way. For the last 10 years, we've been watching, you know, this leadership. And we watch it as critics because we care about the Black community. And sometimes when you try to enter into one of these conversations with one of these organizations, you know, you're pretty much minimized and set aside. And it's not at the end of the day. It's not about helping the masses. It's about, you know, I mean, I understand having a job. You got to have a job. But I think you can do a little bit more because that's the job that you took, okay, was to serve the community, almost, you know, like police officers in some cases. But, you know, to make sure that people were not poor, to make sure people across the street from your building aren't 150% below the federal poverty line. You know, still we haven't seen an upflip from any of these agencies to a normal status, or actually it would be an abnormal status, because normal is them being so far under the poverty line today. And so those lack of ideas and collaborating, you can't bully anybody and go get some money from one of these philanthropic agencies anymore. You know, or call them out and say race. They're not falling for that because they're looking exactly, Mr. Edwards, at what we're looking at in these areas and for our people, economic development, housing, employment, education, et cetera. And it's in a bad space. So if you have no voice,
and
you
there's
have
been
no
a lot
choice.
Of money. But there's been a lot of money, hasn't it, been poured into the African-American community over the last 10, you said 10, I would maintain going back to the article by now Assistant Commissioner of Public Safety, Booker T. Hodges, who wrote a piece back in, I think it was 2011, when he called attention to over $20 million that had been poured into the African-American community since, at that time, he was writing that piece, since 1994, 95, if you will, under the administration of then the first and only African-American and only the second female, Sharon Sells Belton, the wife of Stephen Belton, who is the head of the Minneapolis Urban League, which sits there across the street from. And you mentioned Thor Construction in your declaration before, as we were going on the air. Now, how are things? I had a tour. I went with a associate of mine, by the way, and we kind of toured him. I mean, there's a lot going on in the building, if you will. Nina's in there. The most important entity, I guess, is the county. It's penal colony is in there for people that are on probation and parole and et cetera. Then we have North Point has set up its administrative offices in there. Now, I thought the reason that they pushed Estes's funeral home off of that northwest corner there, kitty corner from Thor and right across the street from the Urban League, etc., because they wanted to expand the administrative operation of North Point. Lo and behold, Thor went up there the other day and had a tour, and I will not discuss some of the things that the folks said about the Urban League and some others, but I mean, things are going well, but it's not what the African-American community had been told to expect as it pertains to this world headquarters of the Thor Construction, which now Thor Construction, in fact, is out of business too, right?
Yes, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, back to the Clark situation, $200,000. I wonder, by the way, I haven't seen anything by Rochelle Olson of the Minneapolis Archive. How much of that went to the attorney? Oops.
Quite a bit, I would imagine, Mr. Evers. It's been a long process. And it ended $200,000 settlement. It's done. You can hoop and holler and say all you want. It's done. It's a done deal.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. But the city of Minneapolis was so dishonest. I mean, and what they did to that black family, including pretending to negotiate in good faith. And for the listening audience, we moved back over to that. We'll leave Thor out there to die in the wind. But, I just could not understand the silence from our community, other than this program, that it was so disgraceful. Really, it was disgraceful. I mean, and we were talking in terms of the angelic and et cetera, that Susan Siegel specifically and the mayor and council and them did what they did. I mean, they actually even brought members of the Clark family to a cafe somewhere and fed them just a little bit of lunch or something like that and pretended to be negotiating in good faith. Man, no sooner than the city council that night, that Thursday night in closed session, awarded the settlement of $20 million, to the Australians, to the Aussies, if you will, they turned around. And if it had not been for the fact that Judge Davis had one of his federal magistrates, and for those that know their civics 101, they understand the role of the magistrate reporting to the presiding judge. If it had not been for the magistrate, Leon, coming back and immediately reporting on Friday, I just want to give the timeline, Don. We have to do that here because people say we're toxic. When the magistrate returned and told on that Friday afternoon, as I understand it, Judge Davis, what had happened, and that they, the city of Minneapolis, you know, with its full glory as they handed off the $20 million, which I understand some of that money, kind of like in the case of our good county attorney, Mike Freeman, went into some pockets. Oopsie daisy. And you know what I mean? You know, kind of like the old Chicago way, passing that envelope under the table, et cetera. But anyway, when Judge Davis clearly found that out on a Friday afternoon, he immediately assigned his law clerk to research the law, go back, take a look at different statements and declarations being made by the city. And then he sent the United States Marshals out that Monday morning and told the five individuals to present themselves, or marshals would come to get them. Wouldn't that have been embarrassing, man, to see a United States Marshal come over to City Hall, go up to the mayor's office, and bring him out, bring the mayor out, and take him across the street to the federal courthouse? Because that's really the way it went down. I mean, you know. And then the delegation of city officials showed up and called itself BSing Judge Davis. Judge Davis, by the way, is a very impressive individual. He's, you know, he's about 6'7". They said it was really funny to watch him sitting up there on the federal bench there in his big chair, looking at them as they called themselves BSing him. He sent them off like school children. He told them that there was a marshal standing over there by one of the conference rooms, and that they had 10 minutes to go in, meet amongst themselves, and decide if there was still room for negotiation. Now, what continued to happen for the next month, I'll be doggone, Donald, if the city continued to negotiate in bad faith until Judge Davis, African-American judge, former chief judge of the Federal District Court of Minnesota, set the trial date. Now, see, I got to tell you, Don, there's only so much I could kind of talk about at this point. They didn't want to go to trial. City did not want to go to trial. Yeah, they did not want to go to trial. So, anyways, that's what it is. I understand that some folks are saying that maybe there should have been a better candidate. What's your thinking on that?
A better candidate as far as, you know, Mr. Edwards, there's, you know, you get a lot of people on social media, you know, including myself sometimes, but usually I try to, you know, stay in the factual area. But there was some concern that this $200,000 isn't enough money. And it was quickly politicized, which it was, and turned racial, and you had some people going at each other. And in some cases, you know, was Jamar Clark, or should have Jamar Clark been the poster person or poster boy for police brutality? I mean, there were several other incidents that happened in that timeline 2 weeks before and I think 2 weeks after where you could have grabbed someone and, you know, really had a true campaign, because some are saying, and these are Black American men and women are saying, that $200,000 was too much.
Isn't that amazing?
Then
that
others,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, and so why did we give him anything, you know? And so that was an interesting take. But on the other hand, you know, if you look at everything that's happening, it's kind of interesting. You know, what do? You have your usual people on the right saying, you know, that she shouldn't have got a dime. You have people on the left saying, oh, that's not enough. But you have a total silence outside of social media. You know, like I said earlier, there wasn't any press conferences. Everyone had their press conference and town hall meeting on Facebook, which, you know, doesn't do anything good.
Yeah, as they normally do. Well, just for the record, I mean, I thought that the $200,000 was not enough based on my knowledge and understanding of all the events, if you will. And, you know, the testimony of some reliable witnesses, including one witness who they attempted to revoke his conditions in terms of probation and send him back to the penitentiary for 16 months. He had a good public defender, number one, and he had a very fair-minded judge, Judge Quam, and they weren't able to do that. But I'll tell you this, I'll tell you a part, so as everybody either pats themselves on the back or pretends that they're not totally up to speed, you know, one of the things that happened Don when the DCA, you know, the powerful DCA there. In fact, DCA is under the direct supervision now of a longtime community person, deputy sheriff in Dakota County and undersheriff for a brief period of time in Ramsey County, my man Booker T. Hodges, is that one of the things DCA did is that the statement, I'm just going to name some of the names right now, if you will, you know, so because it's over with now, like you said. You're absolutely correct, my friend. It's all over with. We have to worry about that. A lot of people can give a sigh of relief. But in the case of the statement and testimony by a man by the name of Jerome Copeland, do you know when the DCA first sent the materials over to the county attorney, Big Mike Freeman, that Mr. Copeland, and not to be confused with Copeland and the Copeland of the construction company. This is an African-American, you know, brother from the streets, if you will, smart young man named Jerome Copeland. Do you know, and I challenge anybody to dare call me and challenge me on this, do you know that his statement given to, given to the FBI, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. In fact, the agent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was a guy by the name of Chris Olson. Do you know that his document, his statement of fact of what he saw that night as what you call it was shot and killed, that it was not sent over? In fact, I had to do a column in the Spokesman Record, and I had to make mention of it back then. In 2016, early 2016, on this program, that Jerome Copeland's statement of everything that he saw as Jamar Clark was being killed, shot in the head, that his statement was lost, if you will. And I'll be doggone, I had people trying to tell other folks that yours truly was being toxic, didn't know what he was talking about because Jerome Copeland wasn't there. Let me just say this in closing, Don. I sat with Jerome Copeland at a location in North Minneapolis as he gave his interview to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the FBI. So you got to be careful with the FBI because they do what is called integrity testing. And FBI agents, they don't get themselves caught out there doing an integrity test where, you know, they take a look and see if you've been a good person or a bad person during the previous year. And the FBI agent told the DCA agent, he could not go along. And what happened, somebody, I don't know who it is, who it was, Donnie, but somebody told Mr. Copeland's attorney as they were trying to send him back to the penitentiary as punishment for stepping up and giving proper testimony and a statement and science statement and et cetera, that the people needed to understand that the FBI said they couldn't go along with it. And so I did a newspaper article, and I talked about it on these programs. And all of a sudden, the county attorney's office called, and the DCA said, oh man, here it is. It was in the back of a drawer, if you will. Yeah, here's the Negro's statement. So I'm just saying that the attorneys for the Clark family, and probably unfortunately unbeknownst to the father of Jamar Clark, those attorneys, who, by the way, were from Denver, Colorado. Do you remember we talked about that on this program, Mr. Allen? They couldn't even find any attorneys in Minneapolis that would take the case. You know, I mean, why?
No,
big Robert Bennett, who made, what was it? Because you read that figure a couple weeks ago, $5 million for doing nothing in the Justine case. When he was asked if he would consider taking the case, he basically indicated he didn't handle Negro problems. In fact, I'll tell you somebody else he did that to, Bob Bennett, Big Bob Bennett. When the Mill City Five, I don't know if you remember that, Don, the five black police officers who sued the city of Minneapolis Police Department, including the current chief, and received $750,000, though actually $2 million was initially put on the table. Ooh. But anyways, when it became known that those officers were telling some of the dark secrets and were going to tell more if they went to trial, they just made an offer of $750,000 to them, and those guys, the five of them, took it and went on about their business. But, you know, I know that our chief has a greater appreciation than people remember of what it's like to get caught up in the corruption, if you will. But anyways, hey, done deal. Again, like I said this morning, brother, my hero is federal judge Michael Davis. He's my hero, man, because if that had been for him, Clark family wouldn't have got a single penny, wouldn't have got a penny down. Anything else? What else we got out there? By the way, phone lines are open, man. You know,
yes, they are.
Because I had heard some threats that there were going to be maybe some people going to call in and kind of get us straightened out, get you straightened out, get us straightened out about the settlement. Are those calls waiting for us?
Let's see here. We do have one caller. Caller, last four, 1924. You're live on the Ron and Don Show. What's your question or comment? Hello, caller. Okay. Yeah, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Oh.
Okay, I think they just want to listen in the queue. Okay, we'll just leave you in the queue.
Okay.
I apologize.
Well, for issue. Yeah, we appreciate it. But again, let's give that number out to our listening audience, 347-426-3904. 347-426-3904. This is the Ron and Don program, coming to you from the heartland of America, if you will. By the way, I see they're still working on things in El Paso. And, you know, they're not saying much about all the blacks that were shot and killed in Dayton. Have we been pushed even further down now as a potential sensitivity?
We are, like, at the just mention and move on list. So, yeah,
okay.
I haven't seen any. I haven't seen any new headlines. I haven't seen, it really, like you said, any mention. I mean, even on social media, when you look through the videos for the news, I think there's like two that show the tennis shoes piled up in front of the place where they were shot in the street.
Yeah.
And it was a creative shot, but it showed and they talked about it. But other than that, I'm not seeing anything from the Washington Post, New York Times, and these are things that I look at every day. So, yeah, we're being pushed back a little bit, I think, to the lower tier of the news, as usual.
Okay, well, it was here on this program a week ago this morning that I broke the story that people needed to kind of remember that it appeared that six of the nine that were shot and killed were African Americans. And I'm going to say this to you again, because obviously you are a former military man, a rifleman, and except for you know the use of weapons as I do. I just was amazed, man, at what a sharpshooter the deceased Mr. Butts was. I mean, do you realize that he killed nine people in 23 seconds and wounded another 26 in 23 seconds?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know Now, we broke that story here a week ago this morning, but he was one heck of a marksman, man, you know, before they blew him away, because they exchanged gunfire. They fired over 120 shots at each other, but we broke that story here. I specifically told you last week that I was going to point out that the six of the nine that were shot and killed in Dayton, Ohio, not Toledo, my poor president. He got himself mixed up. he got to carry a GPS with him. But anyway, six of those nine were African Americans. But I can't see all the experts I've been watching all week on television and et cetera. I haven't seen that person explain how a person could, in a 23-second period, other than firing a cannon, if you will, from a tank, how you could, shoot that many people in 23 seconds, Don Allen. I mean, that was fascinating.
Well,
in a negative sense.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, from another point of view also, and this information has not come out, but it's something that, you know, as a military person I'm wondering about is they said that 21 or 23 people were injured. So where did the police confront this man? Were there people behind him on the side of him, and how many police officers shot?
Yeah. It was right in front of the club. What's the club? Pepper Joe's or something like that. I watched some of the video of the exchange and saw him being hit a couple times by a projectile, if you will. In fact, he was shot in front of the same club where he allegedly shot his sister. You know, as they were running, as they, those people were running into the club. Yeah, and including her boyfriend, who I do believe, if I'm not mistaken, her boyfriend, though they said this was not racially motivated, you know, El Paso is, you know what I'm saying, because you got to keep the Mexican government off of you, because the Mexicans and other Central American governments are raising some questions about the safety of the brown people in the United States. But to your specific question, the firing of the weapon by Mr. Betts, a lot of, most of the people were shot right there in front of that eatery, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Sure was. But again, this man was a fascinating. You know, I'm told by reliable sources that he had been in training at a place called Mars Hill, North Carolina. It's between our McDonald's, North Carolina, and Mars Hills or something like that. It's right there in the so-called Panhandle along the Smoky Mountains of North Carolina. You've been down in that part of the country, Mr. Albert. Yeah, I think you have some relatives down there. But they tell me that Mr. Betts had done some training down there because, well, boy, there's no doubt, Mr. Allen, this guy was a hell of a shot. He was a hell of a shot. 23 seconds, and he injured at least 35 people. Killed 9 of them and wounded the other 25, 26, 27. Yeah, hell of a shooter.
Hey,
but they said his case, and the black people, the Negroes being shot and killed, that was not racially motivated.
Mm.
Guess
we have a caller.
To conclude that they were targets of opportunity. Oops. Yeah. But again, phone lines are open, man. Yeah.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Call
Steve. Hello.
Hey, good morning, sir.
Good morning. Yeah, good morning.
Hey, good morning, sir. How you doing? This is Steve. Yes. How you doing? What can we do for you?
Well, I'm just want to congratulate you and for keeping the Jamar Clark issue out in front of the public, because it doesn't sound like a lot of the leadership up there in Minneapolis was seemed to be particularly interested in it at all. One of the things, though, that I wanted to ask, though, is give a settlement a tacit admission of culpability by the city and the police? It seems like, you know, because you had mentioned they didn't want to go to trial, but then they were willing to settle. So it sounds like there's some culpability there that they don't want to discuss or something, wouldn't you say?
Sir, you're absolutely correct. I mean, any legal practitioner could call and argue with us if they wanted to, but that does any kind of settlement, because actually they had played the family, and it's a doggone good question, and as Mr. Allen has said, and I'm saying, I'm fascinated by the lack of depth of inquiry that is not being made even at this hour. I mean, these are folks that get on social media within 10 seconds. But culpability is a feature of law, if you will, and clearly, particularly in light of the fact that they had angered Judge Davis, who, again, like I said, is my hero. And if not for him, there would be no settlement whatsoever with the Clark family. But that does reflect culpability, if you will, and there was certain evidence. As example, I just talked in terms of a man by the name of Jerome Copeland, who was a witness to the actual death, the actual shooting of Mr. Clark. He was standing probably approximately 25 feet away. And he did something a little bit better than all them folks that have been talking that yang. He gave a statement. And again, for anybody that wants to challenge or question the authenticity, the integrity of what this toxic columnist is saying, I was asked to sit with him when he gave his interview at a specific location. I'm not going to indicate the location. And understand this, Steve, a FBI agent and a agent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I swear to God, they tried to put this man in jail by revoking the probation that he still had left as it pertains to another offense, if you will. They attempted to put him in jail. His public defender and the judge, Judge Quam, said, no, that ain't going to happen. In fact, the guy that attempted to do it was a key figure in the Muhammad Noor case, named Chris Olson. Okay, I told Mr. Allen and others, I said, hey, the case over with now. We can just go on name names and talk about evidence and things like that. But in the case of Mr. Copeland, they initially did not send his statement over. And let me just say this to you, sir. They didn't get that many statements, signed statements, from people in the community who said they were there that night when Jamar Clarks was anyway. Because we like to shoot him in the head up here, you know. A lot of these brothers took them headshots, you know. So, but you know what the word is on the streets is that, well, better to just kill them because it costs less. Shoot them, you wound them, and you got to pay for the medical care and everything. So the statement kind of is better to shoot them to kill them than to have them out here wounded. But again, keep that name in mind, Jerome Copeland, and you will see in my newspaper columns of 2015-2016, I talked in terms of what was happening to Mr. Jerome Copeland, not to be confused with the guy who is the founder of the now-defunct Thor Construction. Yes, sir. But that is an implication under colored law of complicity as it pertains to the incident. But, hey, it's a closed situation now, so folks can come on out from under the tables in a second. Anything else there for you?
Well, I just had a question, too, that you were talking a little bit about El Paso and Dayton. What's the general kind of attitude of people up there in Minnesota about this whole situation and white supremacy?
That is good. I'm going to let my colleague, Mr. Allen, answer that, and I'll come on behind him I'm just going to say it in front. I have heard a lot of reflection and discussion about Dayton particularly, which 6 of the 9 that were gunned down were African Americans. I keep hearing people talk about El Paso and the Mexicans and et cetera. But Ms. Allen, what's your take, man? Are you there with us? What's your take, Ed? Is there a lot of conversation going on social media?
I don't think so. Not in the Twin Cities. Not that I've seen. And it kind of troubles me as much as we like going out to these clubs. And safety is usually our last concern. But even getting information back into the community, I don't see that turnaround in a good process where there's a meeting held at a library or even at a nightclub because people would come out for liquor to talk about stuff. And I'm being sarcastic, but no, there's nothing. And this is something people are surprised. I mean, today to find out that black people were shot in Dayton. I mean,
And our caller, Steve, I wanted my colleague, Mr. Allen, to kind of throw that one out because I've really been amazed at the lack of interest from our community here in Minnesota about the African American shot and killed in Dayton, six in number, and at least 8 or 9, as I understand from sources that I contact with in Dayton. And I appreciate the fact that my colleague Mr. Allen is confirming that. Your question is well covered, Steve. But now we talk a lot about El Paso. The national media talks about the Mexicans. Then you hear folks talking about the Mexicans, but not a lot of people talk about the black folks that were killed there. So I don't know what to tell you on that. I guess we are directed in our mindset and our subliminal. What it is we should be concerned with. And so that means we don't have, I hate to use this word, sir, but we don't have much independence. Oops.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Ian, I had a kind of, well, I don't know if this is a provocative question or not, but I know there's been a lot of talk about the Democratic Party turning left and farther left. I'm really wondering about the Republican Party now. I mean, are they turning farther and farther right? Are they starting to become sort of a almost a white nationalist party now?
I'm going to kick that over to my colleague, Mr. Allen, on the right. Don, go ahead, man, grab it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Edwards. I was screening some calls. Can you ask me the question again?
I could tell he was away from the phone. Steve, why don't you repeat your inquiry and your observation?
I was just saying, just kind of preface it with saying, I know that there's been concern that the Democratic Party is turning farther and farther left. How much concern is it that the Republican Party is turning farther and farther right and maybe heading toward white nationalism now?
Well, I think that's a great question. And the fringe on both sides are going nuts right now. Yeah. And there's a concern that the farther this, whatever this momentum is pushing the righter, is that it's gonna have to break at some point. And you have Bernie Sanders on the left, you have Booker, Kamala Harris, a couple of these other folks, and they're agreeing with, not to get into particulars, but they're agreeing with stuff that they would have never agreed with 4 to 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Especially Kamala and AOC, getting together.
Kamala Harris.
Talking about electric cars.
You're breaking up a little bit, Don. We're getting bad reception there. You're breaking up a little bit. I don't want to miss your observation. Yeah. Go ahead.
So with that said, I think there's a problem. There's an issue. There always is. And I hate the fringes of both sides. And so I'm just watching it, and I'm optimistic about any good outcomes for the black community.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll be just up front with you, Steve. I'm what would be considered to be a leftist, if you will, to fairly to the left, if you will. That's what the Don and Ron program is, the left and the right. I think that both parties are going in a dangerous direction. And then with so many candidates on the Democratic side of the ledger, I'm really, wonder how much of all of these promises that are now being made are that there's really a plan. We always like here on the Don and Ron program to talk in terms of a plan, solutions, if you will. Boy, that's an important word. And so to your question, sir, I'm not sure just how much it is like catching lilacs and daisies and et cetera. You throw them in the air, that folks are saying what they think that the masses want to hear, but they really don't have a plan of solutions. And so it's dangerous both ways. But the fact of the matter is the right in America is more experienced in walking through the killing fields, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
If the left had been involved in anything approaching some of the assassinations that we have seen, in my lifetime, I'm 80 years old, so I'll take on. If we would have been involved in the death of the Kennedys, if you will, if we had blown up white churches and et cetera, first of all, we wouldn't be on this program, because there would be not only a repudiation of the right to express the violence of the left, quote unquote, but it would curtail even more our access to the path of freedom and First Amendment and et cetera. So I don't know why we shy away from the fact that this is a country that's going in two separate directions. But the right, to their credit, if you want to call it that, have a history of being involved in serious events, activities, mayhem, massacres and et cetera. You know what I mean? I mean, there was even a different tune if it had not been for the character and the definitive understanding by President Barack Obama after Charleston. I don't know what would have happened, because there were black folks in Charleston that wanted to kill everything white. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
And
yeah, we just don't have a history. I know of no history anywhere in this nation's history of black folks going into white sanctuaries and et cetera and killing white children, white people, white Christians, and et cetera. So I have to say that the right is accelerating a little bit more quicker than the left. Okay? That's my fix. Anything else?
Oh, okay. No, that's all. I'll listen to the rest of your show off the air here. So thank you, gentlemen.
All right.
Very much.
And just so you understand, today, this morning, I feel that my hero continues to be Judge Michael Tavis of the Minnesota Federal District Court. Thank you, sir, for calling in. Yeah. Don, we got any other calls holding? Because this is a great discussion now. You know, Steve asked a real kind of ugly question of us with regards to our both parties swinging so far out the door that they may not ever be able to come back. So that's what it is. But again, that phone line is open. We've still got about, what, Mr. Allen, 15 minutes or thereabouts. 347-426-3904. Go ahead, bro.
Yeah, phone lines are wide open. Ms. Edwards, I need to bring this up. You know, our condolences are, I should say, our support goes out to the young lady that was shot by her boyfriend in North Minneapolis.
Her boyfriend, Benjamin Case, shot and killed by the police. Yes. Go ahead. I wanted
to touch on it. Go ahead. Yeah, just for a minute here, there's an explanation. I just saw a few of these GoFundMe accounts pop up, and I go and read them in depth, before the production meeting, and there was one that popped up. Says four children in need after parents shot in North Minneapolis, and been shared 249 times. The goal is to reach $7,000. 71 people in 7 days have donated $3,215 to this GoFundMe page, led by a gentleman by the name of Ronnie Williams. And you have some sizable. And you have some sizable, some good amounts. People are doing what they can, and that's good in showing support, but one of the things in the narrative that I read earlier was that the police had taken the van where their clothes were packed because they were moving to North Dakota and the children had no clothing. And I had informed you of this earlier, Edwards, and you asked me to leave a message, which I did on that page, contacting Dr. Booker Hodges, deputy of the Minnesota Public Safety,
Deputy Commissioner.
So I listened to your instructions, and they hit like, they liked it, I guess, but the narrative hasn't changed. And I wrote there that the BCA, your lawyer or someone, should make arrangements to, get your clothes back. But the narrative is there, and Mr. Edwards, it just seemed kind of strange. And I understand that the kids are awards of the state in a way, or with some relative or something like that. So they're being taken care of to the best of our knowledge. Do you have any input on that to let our listeners update our listeners?
Yes, I do. When I first heard that from you, that was being posted, and then I heard the name of this Reverend Ronnie Williams, who indicated that he was the father of the young lady who, and now that they're saying that D.J. Smith, longtime activist, the national president of Bad Dads, and et cetera, has been discovered posting that the mother is paralyzed. I did some immediate checking as I did when you provided me with the information that the children had no clothes, at the van, and et cetera. Let me just clarify so that people understand, because I was kind of disappointed that as many people as we know that are so knowledgeable. First of all, within 25 minutes, 30 minutes that night when Mr. Benjamin was shot and killed allegedly while standing over the mother of at least two of the four children, the BCA, which is under the Department of Public Safety, which is headed by former St. Paul Police Chief, State Senator, and Chief of the Transit Authority, John Harrington. And the head of the section of the Department of Public Safety that handles the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA, they also handle the State Highway Patrol. In fact, I'm at work now with a group of African-American mothers who, and I'm not allowed to go into detail per se, who were really, you know, misused and et cetera after what seemed to be just an accident. So, first of all, within 30 minutes of that tragedy, the death of Mr. Benjamin, this gentleman that you're talking about who was shot and killed, the BCA, acting on the agreement that was made in 2015 with the city of Minneapolis and the then Mayor Betsy Hodges and the city council and all that, took custodial control of the investigation. They impounded the van. They began to question witnesses, particularly even the children and et cetera. And so that investigation is the property of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And the reason that my associate, Mr. Allen, was pointing out that he had text messages to Dr. Booker T. Hodges, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, in which the BCA, State Highway Patrol, the gambling unit that deals with casinos and a separate, all of that is under their custody and control. Now, I made inquiry yesterday, Don, with regards to how that investigation is going. What you are basically told, including Minneapolis police, who the people wrongly accused the Minneapolis police of taking the children's clothes, of not providing for them, et cetera. Minneapolis police have no authority, no control whatsoever. It's no different. And by the way, kudos must go out to Spike Moss, who, working closely with Senator Bobby Joe Champion, has acquired a meeting with the leadership of the Transit Authority. And I'm not leaving the BCA case. I'm just saying there are some people out here that are apparently doing what they have to do, working closely with some other individuals, Ms. Ora Hokes, Reverend Alfred Babington Johnson, and a couple other people, Mr. Moss, working with State Senator Bobby Joe Champion, have forced the Metro Council to meet with a delegation of African-American civil rights activists. And I need to put that out there in the remaining time we have so that folks understand, because there was a lot of concern that those six African-Americans that were run over by a man by the name of George Jensen were receiving no consideration whatsoever. The investigation was dragging along. And I'll tell you this, the county attorney, in a conversation with Mr. Moss 4 days ago, told Mr. Moss, when questions were posed about when Mr. Jensen was going to be charged, County Attorney Mike Freeman, he's back from drying out, if you will. He made the statement that Mr. Jensen is not a flight risk. Now, this was the same day that he was busting, and after an 18-year investigation, I guess, the legendary artist R. Kelly. But back to Mr. Moss, and then back to the BCA. For clarification, is that the BCA controls everything, and what they basically said is that we'll let you know when we get ready to let you know. And that has been conveyed to Dr. Hodges, if you will, and hopefully he's stepped on the pedal a little bit to tell them that they have to do a little better job on how they talk to the African-American community. But I can tell you, having been in two meetings with representatives of the six African-Americans run over at the corner of, run over, pinned under the van and et cetera, at the corner of West Broadway and Lindale, that Spike Moss and Senator Bobby Joe Champion have stepped up and have put pressure. There's going to be a meeting with the new chief Edward Frizzell, if you will, formerly of the Minneapolis Police Department, the head of the Met Council has been suggested to them that they need to be at the meeting. There will be a meeting in the next couple of days. In the meanwhile, the mayor of the city has made inquiry to Mr. Moss and the group of individuals that are part of the civil rights group that had not been previously, notice what I'm saying, Don, had not been previously remembered, but they are in play. Again, some of them are the Reverend Alfred Babington Johnson, Ms. Ora Hoeks, Tyrone Terrell, the leadership group in St. Paul, and a couple of other individuals. So I just wanted to rush to update that because people have been asking me. They say, well, you know, we heard you, Mr. Edwards, talking about the six African Americans that were injured. Two of them are still in the hospital, Tom. They're still in the hospital with critical injuries. But again, Mike, the county attorney said that his good friend is not a flight risk, and that they'll get around to it when they get around to it. You know. And so, so that's what it is. So is that enough of an update for us?
Yeah, that's a great update. People appreciate it. We have about 4 minutes left. Again, that calling number is 347-426-3904, 347-426-3904. You're listening to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio. And being live streamed on the audio, at least, with a picture of a dinosaur in the background on Facebook Live. So people can get it, you know,
yes,
as many
right,
ways as they
all
can.
Right. Yeah. So we've got about 3 minutes left. You know, we're also keeping a tight look on. There are some rumors in the last 3 minutes, Don. We're obligated to keep the information flowing. There are some rumors, troubling rumors, Don, that Chief Mendera Arredondo is in and having some problems with regards to internal problems there. I just hope that, I'll say it like this, I just hope that he's getting the full support from our beloved mayor, Jacob Fry. Because there are some peculiar things that are happening inside of the Minneapolis Police Department, and I'm just not sure that Chief Arredondo is as secure as we are being led to believe initially. You know, he's trying to do the job, but there is some serious undercutting. There were some appointments made earlier this week, and there are questions raised with regards to the individuals that were white who were put into positions of authority, particularly the third precinct, if you will, a couple of other special units. And we also hope that the police department will not, be corrupted by the fact that background checks, and that's big in this country on guns, that background checks now in the Minneapolis Police Department are going to be done by the Internal Affairs Unit under a new commander who really doesn't have a lot of respect for you African Americans. I'm just reporting, Mr. Allen, those information and rumors that are now floating around. I have to say, I can only speak for myself, Donald. I'm concerned about the future of Chief Arredondo. I just hope that the mayor he enjoys the mayor's full confidence, and the mayor will fully support him. But there's some things going on. There's some rumblings going on inside of the Minneapolis Police Department with regards to the possibility of some strong racial bias, if you will. So, hey, that's what the Ron and Don program is here to do, is to update.
Yeah, and Mr. Irwin, next week or maybe even sometime this weekend, we got to talk about this armed man arrested in a Walmart in Springfield, Missouri. Charged with felony, 20-year-old guy. This was published, updated 7 p.m. last night. 20-year-old guy is being held in Greene County for walking to Walmart with a loaded shotgun and body armor. But that's just another piece of the craziness.
Oh, was he an African American? Oh, that's interesting.
No,
he stayed away from that.
He's not an African American. No, he's a white dude.
So I thought I heard you say he was African American. Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah, I heard that story. Yeah, we need to maybe check that now. You know, Springfield, Missouri, not to be confused. to Springfield, Illinois. Springfield, Missouri is one of the last cities to have a quote-unquote what we call legitimate lynching of an African-American. For those that like to go to their computers, take a look at an incident about a decade ago. There's a big television tower that's right downtown Springfield, Missouri. Brother was lynched and hung from there. In fact, I'm going to ask our friend Steve to update us on that lynching of
one more time. Bad loud.
Okay, we got now. Take us home. Take us home, Donnie.